then I'm afraid there are other countries, notably India, who might well leave the United Nations too, rather than stay in and thus take sides firmly in the Cold War. United Nations would soon be no more than an alliance of anti-communist countries. With none of the moral force which United Nations still commands, yet with none of the cohesion and military efficiency of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Moreover, we couldn't expect the Russian and Chinese governments to accept their exclusion lying down. Almost certainly, they would build up a rival organization, including not only the communist world, nearly one-third of mankind, but also in the free countries, the so-called peace movements, which they would present as the shadow governments of the non-communist countries. We should, in fact, not have reformed the United Nations by excluding Russia and China. We should have destroyed it and helped to create a dangerous rival organization. So, in my view, United Nations should continue to represent Soviet Russia, and in due course should also include the communist Chinese. But also, to be of any value, it must find some way round the complete stultification of the Security Council caused by Russia's abuse of the veto. It must implement the proposals called Uniting for Peace, which Mr. Acheson initiated at the General Assembly last year, one of the many fruitful initiatives which your country has taken recently at Lake Success. We can't go back to the old days when all action against aggressors could be vetoed by the Soviet Union. We must develop the powers and importance of the Assembly in dealing with security questions. And Uniting for Peace provides, I believe, a practical and useful way of doing so. Well then, on these two assumptions of Russian and eventual Chinese membership and the successful avoidance of the abuse of the veto, what value can UN be to peace? I believe it can still have some value, enough to make it our duty to continue loyally supporting it. In the fight for peace, United Nations does rally the waverers. That's a common fact of observation. Countries like India do play a part on the world stage, which without United Nations, they would never be willing to do. Recently, for example, they led a gallant bid of 11 Asian and Middle Eastern countries to achieve a ceasefire in Korea, which was welcomed by all those who hoped to see a peaceful settlement. It must be confessed that India's independent line isn't always helpful to the Western powers, but her influence is strong in Asia and is a force for peace. And United Nations not only rallies the wavering countries, it also heartens those who are already convinced. Which of us, no matter how certainly we felt the justice of assisting South Korea against North Korea, wasn't strengthened in their judgment by the fact that North Korea was condemned as an aggressor by 53 members of the United Nations? And if the very worst happened and World War came, which of us wouldn't feel the better for having the United Nations sanction our cause? And then let's remember that there are a whole number of quarrels between nations, many of them lying somewhat outside the East-West struggle, where United Nations has played and can still play a most valuable part in reaching peaceful settlements. It's easy to think that the imposition of solutions is the only role of United Nations in keeping the peace. Well, of course, that's not so. In Persia after the war, in Greece, in Indonesia, in the question of the Italian colonies, United Nations has made a considerable contribution to securing peaceful solutions by conciliation. It can't claim the whole credit for these solutions, but it played a part. It's so easy to dismiss committees of inquiry, conciliation commissions, and so on, as being useless because they haven't got the power to impose settlements and seem to produce nothing except interminable discussion and delay. What is often forgotten, and I say this deliberately, is the constructive contribution which interminable discussion and delay often make. These United Nations commissions enable the leaders of contesting parties to meet each other without being charged with appeasement by their home public opinion. They give time for world public opinion to focus on the problem. Even the boredom which they generate at least lowers the temperature. The result is often a constructive contribution to a settlement. So, bearing these things in mind, I think United Nations has a value for peace. Not as great a value as we should wish, but then there are so few constructive forces for peace in the world today that we cannot afford to overlook the contribution which United Nations can make. But it's also clear that as a means of preventing war, United Nations is not enough. Much more is needed. This is shown by the establishment, for example, of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. To prevent communist aggression, the free world needs unity and strength far beyond what the United Nations can at present provide. May I now speak purely as a British citizen and from a British point of view? I'd like to say something about my country's contribution to the unity and strength of the free world. First, to the unity of the free world. The main characteristic of our policy has been the firmness with which we've maintained that unity must be broadly based. The emphasis has been on the ties between Europe, America, Africa, and Asia, rather than on the ties between the individual countries composing these regions. This attitude, though based on a careful judgment of all the factors involved, arises inevitably from the universality of Britain's ties and commitments throughout the free world. No other country has a foot in so many camps, or is consequently liable to fall between too many stools, if I may mix a metaphor. This is shown by the fact that, with one exception, the conference to launch the Schuman Plan, we, and we only, have attended all the great international conferences at Washington, Moscow, Berlin, Sydney, the Danube, Colombo, and Strasbourg. Britain's a part of Europe, Asia, Africa, and America, and our main contribution has been to help to keep these great regions together. We've refused to jeopardize the overall unity of the free world by too intensive cultivation of ties within one particular region. Well, of course, this policy has inevitably brought us criticism from those who seek greater unity in a more restricted sphere. Some have demanded Anglo-American Federation. Some have demanded Commonwealth Federation. Most of all, however, a considerable body of opinion has urged on us a policy of federation with Western Europe. And this is the criticism with which I'd like to deal briefly. In my view, these critics don't really do us justice. In the first place, we have done and are doing a great deal for closer unity in Western Europe. It was Mr. Bevin's initiative which led to the signing of the Brussels Pact, and subsequently its widening into the Atlantic Pact. We also took a strong initiative in response to Mr. Marshall's offer of economic aid in June 1947. We took the lead in drawing up the convention on which the OEEC at Paris was based. We've been ahead of everyone in carrying out the liberalization of our trade with Western Europe. Our exports to and imports from our Western European neighbors are breaking all records. In the detailed practical work of carrying out the Marshall Plan, I don't think any country has shown more energy and conscientiousness. All the same, it is of course true that Britain has held back from certain far-reaching schemes for Western European unity, in particular from committing ourselves in advance to the Schuman Plan. There's been a point beyond which we were not prepared to go. And I define this point as follows: the point where a closer unity with Western Europe would jeopardize the wider unity of the free world elsewhere. May I give a typical example of this? Some months ago, the OEC in Paris put up a scheme for a European Payments Union, which, if implemented, would have freed foreign currency exchanges in Europe, but which would undoubtedly have broken up the sterling area. Britain flatly refused to accept the scheme in its original form. As the only member of the sterling area, we were the only country to take this stand. Had the OEC been some kind of federal body, instead of an organization which needed unanimity in order to act, we'd have been outvoted by a vast majority vote of the European countries. The European payment scheme would have come into operation, and the sterling area would have been broken up. This would have meant that more freedom of exchange would have been brought into Western Europe at the cost of less freedom of exchange between the sterling area countries. And since the sterling area always has and always will cover a greater amount of trade than any Western European payments union, we should have sacrificed a larger area of free exchange for a smaller area. And the free world as a whole would have been the loser. Britain was able to avoid this because European unity was based on the principle of agreement between governments and not on ties of federation. And incidentally, the subsequent compromise payments union safeguarded the sterling area and is working satisfactorily at the present moment. May I quote one more example, this time in the field of defense? Suppose, as we're sometimes urged, Britain allowed her armed forces to be wholly integrated in a Western European federation, with a Western European defense minister in charge, in such a way that we surrendered our power of decision as to whether a British battalion were to go to Malaya or to Western Germany, surrendered that power of decision to this Western European federation. What then would be the repercussions of that on our political relations with Malaya, let alone Australia and New Zealand, who would also be vitally affected? It's clear that our Commonwealth ties would be badly shaken, or at least greatly transformed. We might, in the hope of increasing the unity of Western Europe, lose links with other parts of the world of even greater value to the Western cause as a whole. Other similar examples could be quoted. Now, I'm not saying that there's not still scope for coming closer to our friends and allies in Western Europe. But at some stage, a choice does sometimes come whether or not to pursue greater unity with Western Europe, even at a price of drifting away from some other area of the world. On these occasions, British leaders must consider deeply and carefully where the wider interest of the free world lies. Now, all these arguments aren't reasons for refusing to unite more closely with Western Europe. We warmly hope, for instance, that we can establish a close relationship with the Schuman Plan organization when it's set up, so that the iron and steel industries of Western Europe can be effectively planned as a whole. In the field of defense, we hope that paper plans on cooperation can be implemented much more quickly and fully than they have been so far. But at this stage, this closer unity should be sought by intergovernmental agreement and not by merging our sovereignty with a Western European group. Then Britain can also foster Commonwealth and other ties with the non-European world. Common sense and experience alike show that this is necessary not only in our own interests, but in the interests of the whole free world. And may I just now briefly look at the other side of the medal, the value to Europe of these special ties which we have with non-European countries. Could the Atlantic Pact and all the activities now being carried out under it have been achieved without the special ties of Britain and Canada with the United States of America? Could the Marshall Plan have been launched so successfully and carried out so effectively if Britain's relations with the United States had been no closer than those of other European countries. Could Asia have shown towards Soviet imperialism even the resistance it has, but for Britain's Commonwealth ties there and her liberal policies, which in India, Pakistan, Burma, Ceylon, and Malaya have prevented communism from linking forces with genuine nationalist movements? Surely these considerations suggest that Europe itself would be the loser if, by demanding Britain's membership of a close federated group in Europe, it weakened our ties with other great regions of the world. Well, now, what about our contribution, not to the unity of the free world, but to the armed strength of the free world? We are, of course, relative to yourself and to Russia, a small country with limited resources. We have, moreover, only recently shaken off the burden of our heavy losses in 5 years of total war. Only recently been able to say to you, with gratitude, with deep gratitude, and some pride, that we can now stand on our own feet without your generous martial aid. This is the background against which our contribution to the anti-communist struggle should, I think, be based, be judged. But first, how great is Britain's will, you may ask? How great is Britain's will to resist communism? My answer is as strong and unshakable as your own. In the struggle for peace, our patience is absolutely inexhaustible. But our country will go Stalinist only over the dead bodies of millions of our citizens.